So this evening, going to continue on with the series that Sims has been doing, and that is dependent origination. And in particular, tonight, we'll continue on for this month's aspect of dependent origination, and that's craving or desire, the wanting. So when I thought about what to talk about tonight about dependent origination, for some reason I recalled back when I was a kid, we played this game called Mousetrap. And it was, maybe some of you have played that game, but it's a board game. And what it is a creation of a better mousetrap. It basically, it's kind of a Rube Goldberg type of contraption. And players go around the board and assemble this complex trap. It involves a crank, a rubber band, and that causes a boot to kick over a bucket. And a ball comes down a ramp and falls into a diving board that launches a man into a bucket, and then a trap comes down and captures the mouse. So that kind of seemed like an apt description or an apt metaphor for dependent origination. And the instruction there, if a rat isn't, or mouse isn't very bright, it's going to grab the cheese. So the trick when you're involved in that sort of thing, don't grab the cheese. Or if you know about this game, don't play the game. And dependent origination is a bit like that. We start out with this sense of not understanding the game. And we play out the game and we get trapped again and again. So dependent origination, it's a set of circumstances, set of conditions that lead to suffering. And the Buddha taught suffering and the end of suffering and the insights laid out in the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are basically four aspects. There's suffering, dukkha. There's the cause of suffering, and that's desire, wanting, craving, which we're going to be talking about this evening. Then there's the ending of suffering, when that's craving is let go of, and there is no ignorance. And then there's the path. So Christina Feldman describes this a bit. She says, in the Buddhist teachings, the second noble truth is not a theory about what happens to somebody else, but is a process which is going on over and over again in our lives, through all our days and countless times every single day. This process in Pali is called paticca. I can have a I wonder if I get this pronunciation right, paticca samuppada, sometimes translated as dependent origination. She continues, the process of dependent origination is sometimes said to be the heart or the essence of all Buddhist teachings. What is described in the process is the way in which suffering can arise in our lives and the way it can end. And that second part is good news. It's quite important. How can the suffering end? So paticca samuppada is said to be the heart of right view or right understanding, the first part, first leg of the Eightfold Path. It is an understanding that is also the beginning of the Eightfold Path, or an understanding that gives rise to a life of wisdom and understanding. So these steps in the dependent origination, which you've been through before, and I'll just review them quickly. It's not so much steps that follow an order, but it's a set of conditions which condition something else. And there's 12 of them that are usually laid out. And the usual way of describing it, it begins with ignorance, a lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths, a belief that one can arrange one's life so that they can avoid suffering. And all you have to do is avoid the difficult stuff and take in the good stuff. There's also a delusion about our sense of self, and that's a big one. We have a sense that we can control things, that we can arrange our lives in a certain way. And these are the foundations of the Four Noble Truths. So without that, there's ignorance. And that creates the condition for sankharas. Sankharas being mental formations, physical formations, verbal formations. They're like programs. Programs that get a certain trigger and off they go. They're programs that have been part of our conditioning from the past, our karma, our historical background, things that are kind of foundations of who we are. And with sankharas conditioned by ignorance, it sets in place, in motion, the next set. And it's almost like a set of things. Consciousness, name and form, our sense spaces, eyes, ears, nose, our mind, and contact. So we come in contact with a form. Our sense spaces come in contact with a form, with an image, with a thought. And consciousness arises with it. And it's all conditioned by the ignorance and the sankharas, which are and been conditioned by the ignorance. And that results in a feeling tone, a sense. There's a sense about this. And it's a pleasant sense or an unpleasant sense, or it's just not even noticed. It's neither pleasant or unpleasant. And based on that feeling, we end up grasping. We end up craving, wanting. I want this. I don't want that. And then that gains a certain momentum. Again, it conditions the next step, which is grasping. It's hanging on to. It's really clinging. It's tightening up around. And then we're off and running. And we're into the suffering of birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, grief, lamentation, and despair. So, these conditions come together. It's a natural effect. Conditions come together, you have a certain result. And it can be likened to a fire, where a fire has these different components. You have to have a fuel. You need heat. You need oxygen. And you need to bring these things together. You can't have the heat over here and the oxygen somewhere else. They're somehow brought together. And as these conditions are brought together, you get fire. Likewise, as the conditions arising from ignorance of sankharas and consciousness and contact and feeling, so on, as they come together, you have a natural outcome of suffering. So it begins with ignorance, a certain sense of me, sense of ourself, our self view, personality view. It's separation. It's a delusion of our being separate from other. And And why would dependent origination be important? Well, it's helpful to understand. Because the understanding of this process of ignorance leading to suffering, it's the understanding of that is what can put out the fire. So our natural tendency is a natural tendency. It's to see ourselves as kind of in control, controlling agents. We can figure things out. We can see the difficulty, and we can avoid the difficulty. It's kind of intuitively obvious, clear to us from our perspective. I can say that for myself. I mean, I'm here. You guys are out there. And also a sense that, yeah, it makes perfect sense. I want to be happy. I'm going to avoid the difficulty stuff. I'm going to avoid the unpleasant. I'm going to avoid the uncomfortable. I'm going to go after what's pleasant. So select the pleasant bits and avoid the unpleasant. It makes sense. Certain sense, certainly. It's diluted, but it makes sense. And the fallacy, to a certain degree, is that we're assuming we can get happiness that way, but yet humans or animals or things in general, evolution did not design us for survival. I designed us for survival. You know, the evolutionary process, we're designed for survival, not for happiness. So operating from our conditioned way of seeing things leads to suffering. You see things more clearly and accurately. If we see things more clearly and accurately, it allows us to make choices. And when we make these choices, we can do things which are not going to lead to suffering. So ignorance is not knowing the nature of things. It's not knowing that we're very connected. There's not this clear separation. There is interdependency that we all have. And so there's a certain mental astigmatism that we have. We seem to be seeing clearly, but things are a little bit out of whack. I use that word astigmatism because the other day, it was about 2 weeks ago, I guess tonight or tomorrow night is the new moon. So about 2 weeks ago, we had a full moon. And I looked out the window. I didn't have my glasses on at the time. It was, I don't know, 9 o'clock or so. The moon had risen. I looked at it, and the moon was kind of not quite round. And I guess it's almost not, you know, not a full moon yet. And I decided to put on my glasses to get a better view. And when I put on my glasses, it's very clear that the moon was round and it was a full moon. So our ignorance is kind of like that. It's a mental astigmatism where we think we're seeing clearly, but things are distorted. It's also a narrow view, you know, a limited view, almost like a truck driver who, when they drive a truck for years, they end up getting a very narrow tunnel vision. So it narrows how we see the world. So when conditions come together like that, there's a natural effect. We are looking through a certain lens, a lens which is creating a distortion. And this lens was created by our conditioning. There's part of it is genetic. Part of it is our family upbringing, our society, our culture, and our actions. As we act out of our ignorance, we reinforce the ignorance, and we continue to see and act along the same lines. So this view, so our view, how we look at the world, is going to lead to suffering, or it's going to lead to the end of suffering. If a person is a thief, let's say, they look upon the world and they see opportunities to steal. If a person has a compassionate view, there's going to be opportunities. One is going to see opportunities to care and give. So the view is very important. And as Christina Feldman said, this dependent origination lays out the view which is not going to lead to suffering. It's going to lead a view which is to the end of suffering. So it can be helpful to get a different view. We're so entrenched in our habitual way of seeing that we end up seeing the same way over and over again. I look in a drawer, looking for in my kitchen drawer, looking for a spoon. And I look, I can't find it. I look more, I can't find it. I just don't see it. And then I turn away and look back, and the spoon was there right in front of me. So we can have things that are seen right, that can be very obvious and right in front of us. But if we start seeing in a habitual way, we never notice. So it's helpful to break out of habitual ways of seeing. And just a couple of examples of this. I'm reading a book on a book I like. It's called Forest Unseen. And the book is about a scientist who studies. He lives in Tennessee, and he has this one spot that he goes through. He calls this his mandala. It's a meter square area in the woods. And in this mandala, he watches over a course of the year all the animals, all the plants, all the interactions of spiders and birds and moss and trees and deer, and how one is feeding on the other and one is supporting the other. He sees an interrelationship of everything within the small mandala. And he's going out there every day. In one chapter I was reading, he goes out there in springtime. And as he goes to this spot, the sun is just rising. And the colors of the sunrise is shining. And with the light of the day, the bird starts singing. The wren sings. The warbler sings. The thrush sings. He hears all these different sounds, and he is part of that. And then he goes into the science of it. But what the picture he is painting is how interrelated even a small meter of life is, all integrated. And he's part of it. And I want to just read one thing as he says. He talks about, gets into a, both the close-in look at the small area as well as looking broadly through the universe. And he talks about the sun when it rises, how the birds hear it, and with the light of the day, they start singing. And he says, the light and sound energies washing over the mandala find a point of convergence in my consciousness where their beauty quickens a flame of appreciation. There is convergence also in the start of the energy's journey in the unimaginably hot pressure core of the sun. The sun is the origin of both the dawn light, the birds' morning songs, the glow on the horizon is light filtered through our atmosphere. The music in the air is the sun's energy filtered through the plants and the animals that powered the singing birds. The enchanted enchantment of an April sunrise is a web of flowing energy. The web is anchored at one end by matter turned to energy in the sun, and at the other end by energy turned to beauty in our consciousness. And I read that, I just get the sense of how interconnected, how much we are integrated into nature as opposed to being separate from. So it breaks, it kind of loosens up that sense of self that we tend to grab onto, that this is who I am. And it helps to open that up. Another way of looking differently is what the Buddha did. He started looking very closely. He started saying, I'm going to check this out. I'm going to see what this is like. I'm going to see what this suffering is all about. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, it wouldn't have occurred to me that to have that type of self-reflection, to just start watching the mind, to just start watching what's causing suffering, just start noticing what's ending suffering, start realizing all the patterns. So the Buddha studied this and came up with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, a plan describing suffering and the end of suffering, an understanding of impermanence and change, and of dukkha resulting from trying to find happiness in impermanent situations, and understanding also of a sense of not self. So the Four Noble Truths is like a prescription of glasses for the mind. And with this prescription, we get an opportunity to respond. And things can be noticed. As we grasp and we cling, we can notice that. As we have unpleasant or pleasant feelings, it can be noticed. And we're not carried by the conditioning. So rather than seeing through the lens of ignorance, we see through wisdom. And then all the conditions and how we see and relate to the world are imbued with that wisdom. The mental formations, consciousness, the contact, vedana, or feeling tone. And so our view will condition how we see and respond to the world. So what is craving? I see this as the pivot point. It's kind of, we've had this setup, we've had the consciousness with the awareness of contact and form and vedana responding with pleasant or unpleasant. And now craving with desire, with wanting, responding to vedana, responding to those feeling tones. To me, there's different parts of this dependent origination. The first part I see is ignorance and the sankharas. It's kind of the setup. It's a jumping off point. Then the setup is consciousness, the name and form, sense bases, and contact. All those things that come together and have some sort of awareness, something that can be we can be aware of. And the next three are feeling, the feeling tone, the craving, desire, and then the grasping. I see those three coming together. Then finally, we're off and running with birth, death, sorrow, old age, and so forth. So this feeling tone, the craving, desire, and the grasping are often places that we can become aware of. This is often where we practice our meditation. This is where we're mindful of, to notice how do these, how does our feeling tone feel in our bodies? To notice how does wanting feel in our bodies? So the word in Pali for wanting, for desire, is called tana. And different translations, basically wanting, desire, but it's also like an unquenchable thirst. It's such a strong thirst, you just can't be satisfied. And it's this part, it's this tana, this type of wanting. This is the desire that's referred to in a second noble truth. This is the cause of suffering, that grasping, that wanting. And this is what the second noble truth is. It must needs to let go of that. So what happens when we have Vedana, when we have these feeling tones, there's a partial sensitivity. We don't take it all in. We limit what we want to see. So the tana, in response to the Vedana, is it comes in three forms. One is wanting sensory pleasures. We want fun vacations. We want good food. We want wonderful entertainment. We want the things that are pleasant and don't want that. It's a distracted life. We want to want. So, people go on vacation. I go on vacations. We take trips. When we come back from trips, it's interesting. Or any type of social gathering where people get together. Say, how are you doing? Well, what people do, we share our experiences. We share our fun things. We share, oh, I just went on this trip. Had a great time. Had great food. Went swimming. Went and saw all these different animals, went hiking. So we can talk about all these pleasant experiences. And at the same time, another way we can go is we can say, boy, it was terrible. It was lousy. It rained every day. We can tell our suffering stories. The way I relate to the Vedana in regard to the tana, we identify with the pleasant or unpleasant. So it creates our identity. We can't have a very good social conversation if what we're talking about, well, nothing really much happened here. I went on vacation. Nothing really happens. We all have a way that we need to tell stories. We want to become another type of grasping that we do is wanting to become someone, become something. We have notions about what is a preferred way of being. Want to look good, want to be admired, want to get enlightened. I'm a meditator. I should be patient. The COVID thing is happening. And I want to take care of people. I'm going to wear a mask. I do wear a mask. Because other people don't wear masks. They don't care about people like I do. Or I might have an identity around, oh, I'm a tough guy. I want to look strong. I don't want to look weak or vulnerable. All that grasping is dukkha. Wanting ourselves to be this way. And not that way. It takes a lot of effort. And there's a way that we want to get rid of or deny aspects of ourselves that don't match our image. I want to be neat. I don't want to be messy. I'm responsible. I don't want to be irresponsible. So this image of ourselves is a burden. You know, it can be really a struggle to maintain, to look good, get our preferred image, and to keep the shadow hidden from view. You know, wanting to get rid of aspects of ourselves. You know, don't want those unpleasant thoughts. Don't want those angry thoughts, those bad feelings. All this is suffering. So when we have pleasant feelings, our grasping hijacks. You know, basically, pleasant feelings are hijacked by desire. You can't just have the pleasant feeling. We collapse around it. We try to hang on to it. Unpleasant ones get hijacked by aversion. You know, the experience itself is replaced by aversion. Experience the pleasant experience is replaced by wanting. And in neutral, there's nothing to grasp. And so we're missing everything. We miss that part. Much of our craving is around thoughts. I don't know if you notice this, you know, I find myself brainstorming, you know, things to want, especially if I'm uncomfortable, if I'm kind of fussing about this, feeling a little bit bored. So what do I want? Oh, maybe I should go for a walk. Maybe I can see what's in the refrigerator. Maybe I could check out what's on TV. If the current moment is uncomfortable, aversion, we find a way to wiggle away from the present experience. I have a friend who's here tonight, Andrea. She went to Trader Joe's earlier this week, and she texted me, "You want anything from Trader Joe's?" I immediately responded, "Yes, I want soy creamery ice cream, the cherry and chocolate chip version." Now, I just had that soy creamery ice cream a week ago. In a very short period of time, I downed a whole quart of that. The next time, I also went to Trader Joe's since that time. And I said, "I'm not going to get another quart of ice cream. I can't bring that into the house. I'll just blast through it." So there's a certain wisdom when I went to Trader Joe's the previous time. And I decided not to bring it into the house. But Andrea says, "You want anything from Trader Joe's?" I jumped on it. "Yes, I want that ice cream." So there wasn't a reflection. There was no reflection, and it just happens. It was ignorance, conditioned wanting. So I got the ice cream. Thank you, Andrea. And I proceeded to go through it within 24 hours. And this is craving. This is wanting. This is tana. But this is an interesting one, I find. It wasn't really the ice cream. The fact that I went through it in a short period of time, it wasn't the ice cream that was the issue. What was really going on is that I was working on this talk, and I was trying to figure out what to say. And there was certain uncomfortableness about it. Okay, what do I say? So there's a certain just little funny agitation, you know, and I didn't like this agitation. I didn't like this, and I wanted to get away from that. I did not want that uncomfortable feeling. So I brainstormed, what could I get? And I had ice cream in the freezer. So I went and got the ice cream again and again and again. it wasn't a wanting of ice cream. It was a wanting to get rid of an unpleasant feeling, this little nervousness. So in terms of our practice, it's helpful to recognize, well, what's going on here? What's the real desire? What is the real aversion? So wise practice at this time would have been just stopping, just noticing the agitation, noticing the nervousness around that wanting, and coming around to allowing it to be, and allowing that agitation to run its course, and allowing that agitation to pass. And with the passing of the agitation, there would be no desire for ice cream. So, this is kind of what our practice is. There's any one of these, when we use our mindfulness, we can become aware of the ignorance itself. We can become aware of the formations, our sankharas. We can become aware of what happens when our eye sees something. Some of the most obvious places where we can practice so is with this connection between Vedana, Tana, and then Upadana, the next month's practice of really grasping and clinging. This is where it's obvious. And by recognizing how we grasp and knowing the patterns, we can learn how to be with the uncomfortableness of it. We can learn how to relax around it. We can learn how to let go of that grasping. And then we can practice the second noble truth, where we recognize the grasping. And we can recognize the third noble truth, and what is life when there is no grasping. And notice that without the grasping, there is not suffering. Now, we can also have wholesome desires. It's not all desire for things which aren't helpful. We can have desires for social justice, harmonious living, ending poverty, our own welfare, welfare of others, sustainable planet. There's a bit of a definition issue here. Desire does not serve. In Pali, the word is tana. And Pali, the tana is desire, which is the result of ignorance. It's what was conditioned by ignorance. So these wholesome desires are not tana. And I looked this up, it said, they call it chanda, which are wholesome desires. So desires, it's not something that's bad. It's not something that we're trying to get rid of desires, but rather we're trying to how to relate to the desire. And if it's a desire that isn't helpful, if it's tana, allow it to pass and refrain from acting on it. But I also find it's helpful to recognize our wholesome desires. And I guess I want to kind of, as I've thought about this practice, and I thought about dependent origination, I thought about craving this past couple of weeks in preparing for this talk, I reflected on how does this work in terms of our issues in our society. How does this work? How do we practice with this in terms of COVID-19 and the pandemic? How can we practice in regard to climate change? How can we practice with wanting and ignorance in regard to racism and the institutional racism that's been going on for 400 years. How do we respond to poverty and inequities of wealth? And as I thought about this, you know, I thought about my white privilege. I thought that I can pretty well live a life because of my privilege without having to deal with climate change or racism or poverty. I can pretty much surround myself with pleasant things. It might not be a perfect world, but I can pretty much go through life in a kind of a reasonably comfortable way and not really have to deal with the difficulties of life. So as I thought about this, and I value, you know, the basic Buddhist teaching of suffering and the end of suffering, and the intention of living a life for my welfare and the welfare of others. A key thing that I cling to, that I grasp, is my privilege. I grasp the comfort I have. Because it's difficult to look at suffering in others. I pretty much limit my practice to, okay, I feel agitated now. Let's see, how can I deal with that? I can deal with the agitation in my own lives. So I appreciate having to do this talk because I think it was a bit of a certain eye-opener. The way, the degree to which it's possible to have this, protect ourselves from not seeing, from seeing the difficulties. And I think this practice is asking that. I think our times are asking that. I think our times are asking us to turn to the suffering that's outside of us and to allow suffering in, to allow other suffering in, and not just arrange our own lives in this comfortable way. I want to end the talk today by a quote from or something that Carl Sagan said. Maybe some of you, a lot of you are probably familiar with this. It was when the Voyager 1 spacecraft was heading out to space, it passed the different major planets, large planets, Saturn, Jupiter, went on to Uranus and Neptune, taking unbelievable pictures. It went farther and farther, 3.5 million miles, I think it was, away from the Earth. Carl Sagan said right before the batteries are going to shut off, right before the camera is going to shut off, he said, turn that camera around and take a picture of the Earth. And so they did. They took a picture of the Earth. And they looked at that picture that they took. And they had a very hard time finding where Earth was in that picture. And it showed up as just this pale blue dot. The tiniest little dot in one corner of the frame. And Carl Sagan says, and I guess I'm bringing this up about widening the view. And Carl Sagan said, look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being, whoever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every super leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended on a sunbeam. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe are challenged by this point of pale light. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Now let's sit for a minute. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. Oh, thank you for your attention. So I am thinking we could have a small group discussions, maybe for about 10 minutes and then a Q&A. And if people aren't interested in being in a discussion, now would be a good time to break off and head out. And if you are, hang on and I'll put you in breakout rooms. And I think I want to follow up on that last kind of comment I was making about, I'm curious, to what degree or how do we kind of keep our in our comfort zone? We found a reasonable comfort zone because we can. And it keeps us away from opening our hearts, our minds, to the difficulties in life, these very clear and present dangers and areas of suffering of racism, climate change, poverty, injustice. So I'll break into groups of three and consider that. Maybe consider how we might be protecting ourselves and what we could do differently in regard to this practice and dealing with what we're grasping. So, anybody have any comments that want to share from their discussion or questions for that matter? Talk. If you do, just unmute yourself and we happen to talk over each other. You can just pick who goes first.
I'll just say that the four of us really felt it was a good thing to think about, to reflect on, that we all did have feelings of wanting to, you know, grasp, keep a hold of our comfort, and that we were aware of that. And so anyway, it was a good question. We're glad you brought that up.
Yeah, thank you.
In our group, we reflected a little bit about having the awareness to know one's own heart's capacity so we don't cause ourselves more suffering, and we stretch and we are kind to ourselves.
Yeah, that could be a challenge. Yeah, I think about the kind of basic intention, you know, for my welfare of others, and leading to peace, and we're one of them. We're swept into that, and it's important. I mean, if we're to be effective at working on whatever we're doing, there's a way that we need to take care of ourselves, so that we can have the energy and the alertness and strength. I remember an old metaphor that somebody, or story that somebody said, that about trapeze artists, that before you catch somebody, you know, people do their flying through the air and tumbling, and one person catches another. Before you try to catch somebody, make sure you're well attached to your own trapeze and you take care of yourself. So I think that goes for a lot of things. And parenting, social activism, and trapeze artists. I personally I'm far more comfortable than I need to be, and it's out of habit. Yeah, I get inspired by this story or that story. And it fades as I settle into comfortable habits again. And anyway, I just like bringing attention to that. Took a compassion cultivation training a number of years ago. And compassion in this training is started by Stanford. Compassion is something that can be learned. We have a capacity for it. And one of the practices was being aware of what you're aware of. So, you know, the image that I think about, I walk into Trader Joe's, not necessarily buying ice cream, but other things as well. And I have an agenda. I can go through the list. This is what I want to buy. I can get so focused on that list that I don't notice anybody else. I don't notice the real change salesman. I don't notice the cashier. And it's one of my practices. I really try to remember or recall or be mindful of what agenda, how is my current agenda serving anything beyond myself.